Welcome to Virginia On Demand, a weekday podcast from Radio IQ News, featuring the top headlines from around the Commonwealth. I'm Nicholas Yee, sitting in for Jeff Bossert. It's Wednesday, May 13th. This week is Police Week across Virginia, and as Michael Pope tells us, modern policing works very differently than it did a few years ago.
Since 2020, Virginia has repealed the death penalty, implemented earned sentence credits, changed how probation works, allowed for expungement of criminal records, created mental health alternatives, and eliminated jury sentencing. Alexandria Commonwealth's attorney Brian Porter says the biggest change to policing in the last few years has been decriminalization of marijuana.
That's really changed the context of policing. Many searches by police officers were predicated on the odor of marijuana emanating from a motor vehicle pursuant to a traffic stop. And that's now no longer a valid reason to conduct a search of a car. That's explicit in the code, and it's something the legislature has made very, very clear.
Sean Winetta is a criminal justice reform advocate for Cavalier Consulting, and he says the biggest reforms have been ending the failed war on drugs and abandoning the harsh mandatory minimum sentences of the 1990s.
What we know from all the data is that severity of punishment doesn't deter behavior. Certainty of punishment does. So I think there's been more efforts into making sure that people are caught versus making sure that people are punished really harshly, and also making sure that we're getting people resources they need to, you know, maybe address the issues that they had that led them to criminality.
Advocates say another consequential change that will yield future reform is all the new data officers now collect about their interactions. Michael Pope.
Predicting where and when a flash flood is going to hit can be difficult, especially in the mountainous rural terrain of Southwest Virginia.
We're not going to know until real time that a flood's ongoing. And then we rely heavily on local data. And in Appalachia, we have huge gaps in those data on the ground.
Still ahead, how that's fueled the danger to residents and what is being done to improve the data for forecasters and first responders. Katie Burke's story from Daint is coming up in a few minutes here on the podcast. Virginia elected officials once again tweaked state law around electronic cigarettes or vapes this past winter. Meanwhile, the federal government expanded the number of vapes that could end up on Virginia shelves after the new law takes effect. Brad Kuttner has this report.
New rules by the Federal Drug Administration released this month aim to combat, quote, illicit tobacco products in this country, and they do so by expanding the number of approved vape products that could be sold in the U.S. Legislation in Virginia aimed to curb vaping, or at least the number of stores selling dangerous, unregulated products, is set to go into effect this summer. And Virginia Attorney General Jay Jones says the federal and state efforts complement one another.
Well, look, the good news is that FDA-authorized products are eligible for inclusion on our product directory, and we're excited because on July 1, it will become harder for minors to buy vapes in Virginia than it ever has been before.
Virginia's vape registry went into effect last year, but it relied on a list of FDA-approved vapes to help define which were and were not legal. Now, after much waiting, that list will help inform Virginia law. From there, Jones' office and the State Alcohol Beverage Control Authority, or ABC, will take over enforcement.
We will maintain the directory and then continue to work with ABC from an enforcement perspective, which we think is the right scheme to really make a meaningful impact to get these products out of children's hands.
Virginia's new vape law goes into effect July 1st. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Residents who voted in West Virginia's primary election yesterday had to present a valid photo ID in order to vote. The law passed last year no longer allows the use of non-photo forms of identification like utility bills, bank statements, hunting and fishing licenses, bank or debit cards, and concealed carry gun permits. Acceptable forms of photo IDs include a driver's license, U.S. passport, military ID, employee ID issued by a government agency, and a student ID from a high school or college. This was the first election with the new rules in place. Over the next 20 years, Dominion Energy says demand for power will double, and it hopes to get half of that electricity from solar. Yesterday, the company unveiled its latest array in a surprising location, as Sandy Hausman reports.
When the Ivy Landfill near Charlottesville closed in 2002, the local waste authority spread land on top and began growing grass. There wasn't much else it could do, according to director Phil McAlips.
It's all built on buried trash. You can't do anything with it because it's a landfill.
But Dominion Energy saw an opportunity. It offered to lease and maintain 7,200 solar panels on the 14-acre site, a deal the Rivanna Solid Waste Authority could not turn down.
It's money instead of expense to us, so it's really nice.
Utility spokesman Tim Eberle says renewables now make up just 10% of Dominion's energy mix, but that will change.
We're expecting to have to add about 33 gigawatts of new power, and we are expecting more than half of that to be solar. It's going to be playing a huge role in our power generation strategy over the next 20 years.
Eberle says the Ivy site, smaller than what it now plans for arrays in Henrico and James City County, cost nearly $15 million to install, but the company pays nothing for fuel. I'm Sandy Houseman.
West Virginia held some state and federal primaries yesterday. Incumbent U.S. Senator Shelley Moore Capito easily held on to her party's nomination. Capito will face Rachel Anderson, who won the Democratic Party primary in November. This summer marks the country's 250th birthday. It's also the 50th anniversary of a large cross-country biking trip called the Bike Centennial. Several riders are planned in Virginia this summer, and a professor produced a podcast exploring the history along the route, as Roxy Todd reports.
In 1976, more than 4,000 cyclists from around the world came together to explore the backroads of America. Also known as Route 76, the Trans-American bike route begins in Yorktown and ends in Oregon. The ride was planned as a grassroots effort to honor the country's bicentennial. Virginia Tech history professor Tom Ewing says then, as now, Americans saw rising oil prices due to unrest in the Middle East.
And so a lot of discussion about bicycles in the mid-1970s is about alternatives to driving a car.
Route 76 runs over 500 miles through Virginia, bypassing most cities. It goes through Damascus, Charlottesville, and an intersection just outside Blacksburg, where Ewing rode his red bike for this interview.
The Bike Centennial itself is very much connected to the early stages of American environmental awareness.
There are several biking events planned this summer to mark America's 250th birthday. The largest ride doesn't go through Virginia, though several cycling groups are planning other trips in the Commonwealth, traveling roughly the same route as the original Bike Centennial. Reporting from Route 76 in Montgomery County, I'm Roxy Todd.
The search for a new president at Virginia Tech will take longer than originally expected. Cardinal News reports the university has hired a national firm to conduct that search, which could take 6 to 8 months. That's far longer than the July 1st target date initially floated by the rector of Tech's board. Outgoing president Timothy Sands, who has been with the school since 2014, will remain in the position until a successor is chosen. And a note of disclosure, Radio IQ is a service of Virginia Tech. July 18th was a sunny summer day in Russell County in Southwest Virginia until a thunderstorm cropped up over the small former coal town of Daint. No one thought much of it. Afternoon storms are common in July, but this one was different. The ground was already wet from days of rain, and the storm became a deluge. Katie Burke explored why forecasting these floods is so tricky.
Tina Sanders didn't learn she needed to evacuate from the radio or TV.
It happened so fast. Within an hour, there was water everywhere.
Tina was taking a Sunday nap before going to church that afternoon when a ruckus outside awoke her. Seeing the water rising and her neighbors fleeing, Tina and her fiancé evacuated too, but they got stuck in rising water at the bottom of their road, near where Lit Creek runs through a tunnel under the train tracks. They got sucked into that culvert along with their vehicle. In the center of Daint, Tina's partner pulled himself out, but Tina couldn't.
I was gripping on to the pavement, trying to hold on and trying to get help, but the current was so strong it sucked me back into the culvert.
She was pulled through a hole where the pavement had collapsed.
My head hit the cement, cracked my head open. I don't know how long I was under there, but I was beat and banged, and the Lord got me through it.
The emergency rescue team was waiting for Tina at the next bridge.
I told the Lord, go in and take me. They pulled me out right about that time. When I first come out, I couldn't breathe.
Tina was taken to the hospital and says she's okay now.
I come out without a broken bone and just a few staples in my head.
21 people lost their homes. Thankfully, there were no fatalities. The flood blindsided Tina, her neighbors, and emergency responders. Flooding is the deadliest natural hazard in Southwest Virginia, and it's intensifying because of climate change. A Climate Central analysis predicts that by 2050, Virginia could see a 19% increase in flood losses from the $856 million total in 2020. Southwest Virginia will face the brunt of those losses, along with the Chesapeake Bay and Norfolk areas. In Russell County, the Daint flood occurred within the same year as Hurricane Helene, a February flood, and bad winter storms, each compounding the strain on resources. Russell County Administrator Lonzo Lester oversaw the response to them all.
The county, we started expanding our emergency services and our first response, not just into the search and rescue, but we implemented over 17 community centers.
A big isolated summer storm like the one that caused the Daint flood is hard to predict, even in the best of circumstances. Craig Ramsayer studies flood prediction at Virginia Tech.
We're not going to know until real time that a flood's ongoing. And then we rely heavily on local data. And in Appalachia, we have huge gaps in those data on the ground, particularly rain gauges that are reporting at a resolution of, like, say, an hour.
The radar model estimates just over 3 inches of rain that day in Daint, which Ramsayer says may not be accurate.
We've been in this unique space where we don't have great rain gauge data, and the radar data we do get may have some errors that are quite large.
Solving this issue isn't straightforward because even when there is data, it isn't all in the same place. Aaron Rothman is co-founder and chief scientist of Merrick Labs and has been working in neighboring Buchanan and Dickinson counties. Her work is funded through a nonprofit called Rise Resilience Innovations.
National Weather Service has some information. NOAA presents some information. USGS presents some information. And VDEM presents some information, but nobody consolidates everything in one spot, which is mind-boggling.
Rothman and her team pulled together a ton of data, spatial information, weather forecasts and radar models, flood risks, and water levels.
It's kind of like a real-time control center for flooding. Once we get a ping within the next 72 hours that we're supposed to expect something, we start tracking that forecast and then notifying the county or emergency management that there is a storm coming.
Local governments can get their own rain gauges. Rothman recommends ones that send their data to satellites every 5 to 15 minutes. But in this variable terrain, you can't monitor every watershed.
That's why we try to prioritize the scenarios that we know flood repeatedly or more people are going to be impacted or whatever the reasons are that the county identifies as a priority.
In Daint, the Virginia Department of Emergency Management has taken an important step toward filling the weather data gap in the region. In April, they installed a top-notch rain gauge at Artie Lee Campground, which is above the area that flooded. In Daint, I'm Katie Burke.
This story is a collaboration with Climate Central and was supported by the Pulitzer Center. Weather-wise, cloud coverage increases through the day with showers and storms this afternoon and evening, especially for western Virginia, where some stronger storms will be possible. Breezy overall with highs in the upper 60s to near 80 for Danville. This evening, showers and storms will continue before skies start to clear from west to east after midnight. A little breezy, low temperatures in the low 40s to around 55 for Richmond. That's a wrap for Virginia On Demand for Wednesday, May 13th. My name is Nicholas Yee. Thank you so much for listening. And of course, do subscribe to this podcast and tell your friends about it. For Radio IQ News, thank you so much for listening.